This is a very exciting chapter, and I think one that all of us know pretty well. And I hope you notice kind of in the subtitle of chapter 3, it does not say for ages 10 and under. But I think that's sometimes how we treat this story. This is for all ages and has some very practical, powerful applications for every one of us, however old we are. I would sometimes tell this story to my kids that we're going to study about Shadrach, Meshach, and to bed you go when I wanted them to get to bed. Enough of that. Daniel 3 is a little bit unique to the first two chapters where we don't have a time frame given as to when this story occurred. It seems to me it probably happened pretty soon after chapter 2. There's a lot of connections to chapter 2. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed of this great statue, and he's trying to make his dream come true in chapter 3 by actually building a statue of gold. At the end of chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar promoted Daniel and his friends, and we'll kind of see them in that promotion role in chapter 3. If you look at chapter 3, verse 12, and compare that to 249. We've seen the pride of Nebuchadnezzar in chapters 1 and 2, and it is really on full display here in chapter 3. You can just kind of see his pride in telling the people, I want you to build a 90-foot tall statue, 9-foot wide, and overlay it with gold. And it takes some king, right, to make such a command. But in verses 1 through 7 of Daniel chapter 3, we see kind of the plan thought up by Nebuchadnezzar. And it's to build this massive statue, which would have taken a lot of manpower, and to overlay 90 feet tall by 90 feet wide would have taken just an extreme amount of gold. Very expensive statue that he is putting in this this plane. So we have Nebuchadnezzar says, whenever I blow the trumpets and the music, everyone is to bow down to this statue. Now, did you ever think about why Nebuchadnezzar wanted this statue? In his eyes, this is kind of his dedication to the God of Babylon. Well, what has the God of Babylon done for Nebuchadnezzar in his eyes? Well, this is the greatest God on earth, right? Because he has defeated the Assyrians, the Egyptians, people of Judah. So this is the great God. So this is kind of a dedication to that God. And Nebuchadnezzar demands everyone be present. The rulers, it doesn't matter who you are all to come. And you see the herald's kind of proclamation there in verses 4 through 6. Everyone is to bow, and the penalty in verse 6 is if you do not bow, you immediately go to the fiery furnace of blazing fire. What you notice with Nebuchadnezzar is he demands obedience. And if you do not obey, then you get immediate death. Well, in verses 8 through 18, some charges are brought against three particular Jews. These Chaldeans wanted Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego to be killed. And if you look at the text, this is more they don't like these Jews than it is I feel really bad for the king doing all this and they're not respecting the king. And so they want these Jews executed. So they go to Nebuchadnezzar, and in verses 9 through 11, they remind Nebuchadnezzar of this wonderful law that he has put forth regarding the image, the statue. And then notice verse 12 of chapter 3, that there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Nebuchadnezzar, they have disregarded you. Their accusations are against three men that in the end of chapter 2 he promoted because at Daniel's request. And now these men are over kind of the administration of Babylon. So that's the capital city. And so do you want these men to disregard you, men of high influence? You have made a mistake, Nebuchadnezzar, by putting these men in charge. They do not serve your gods. They don't even worship the golden image that you have spent so much money, time, and effort putting up. Well, Nebuchadnezzar responds beautifully in their eyes. Right? It went exactly as they wanted. They appealed to Nebuchadnezzar's pride, and Nebuchadnezzar is ready to follow through with his threat. Let's put these men in the furnace. Maybe some time passes in between the middle of verse 13. By the time Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego come to him, he's willing to give them a second shot. He says, I hear some accusations, and I tell you what, if when the music plays and you bow down, then all is well. We'll just forget the whole thing. And notice the question in verse 15, because I think this is the point of the entire chapter. Nebuchadnezzar asked these men, and what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? I am the most powerful person on earth, and there is absolutely no God who can rescue out of this situation, out of this fiery furnace. So he is admitting that not even his own God that he has spent all this time to set up can do this. What God is there? Well, how would you react if you're one of these three men? Would you lie about not bowing down? Would you cave in and bow down when the music is played? Would you justify your decision? So if I bow down, I can keep living and I can still try to promote and influence people to serve the Lord. It's a very scary situation to be in. I think it's really easy for us to say, oh, I would have done the exact same thing that these three men did. When your life is in deep jeopardy, all of the sudden this came upon them. Things were going really well. At the end of chapter 2, they were promoted. They stood up to the king's orders in chapter 1. God blessed them in that. God had favor with them. Everything is great. And now, because of this one law, they are about ready to die. Notice verse 16 through 18, where they give this very powerful answer. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. I don't know how many people have told Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer, O king, to your question. Our God is able to answer your question in verse 15. What God is there? Well, our God is able to do that. And then he says, he will deliver us from your hand. We're going to get back to that in a moment. But I want you to think about that. Our God is able to do this, and he will deliver us from your hand. And then he says, but if he does not, then we're still not going to serve and worship or bow down to this golden image. So in verses 19 to 23, Nebuchadnezzar gives them the death penalty. He's filled with wrath. Not many people have ever spoken to him like these men did, especially as he was king. Gave them a second shot, very generous of him, and yet they still would not do this. He orders the furnace. If just normal fire wouldn't kill them, maybe if you pump it up seven times more, that'll get the job done. So he orders them to be tied up by valiant warriors. And they are sent in the furnace with all this clothes on and caps and other clothes, and they fell into the midst of the fire. And as Nebuchadnezzar is watching this unfold, he sees a fourth man in the fire. And later he says, well, it's an angel. We don't know exactly who it was. But notice it says that they were loosed in the fire. The only thing that the fire burned was what they were tied up with, right? And so now they're loose, they're walking around, and Nebuchadnezzar is amazed, and he says, "You servants of the Most High God, come here. The God you serve is truly the Most High God, not the God of Babylon that I spent so much time and money erecting." God answered his question back in chapter 5 or verse 15. What God is there to save you? O God, Meshach, Shadrach, Abednego, truly is the Most High God. And the fire had no effect on them at all. All their clothes they were wearing were not burned. They didn't even smell like smoke. And so Nebuchadnezzar gives a new decree at the end of this. In verses 28 and 29, he blesses God who sent his angel and delivered his servants. He blesses Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and because they put their trust in their God, and because they violated my command, and they were even willing to die for this God who is able to save. They were devoted to their God alone. And because of their faith, their trust, notice what God does with that. God says, anyone who mocks or makes fun of the God that these men serve, they will be torn limb from limb. Their houses shall be reduced to rubbish heap. And in verse 30, he causes these men to prosper because of their great faith. What a powerful story, right? What a wonderful story. This story really shows the kind of faith that we need to have, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But I think too many times what we do is we promote the wrong people in this story. We promote Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and we forget the Most High God, who is the real hero, of course, in this story. So I want us, as we make applications, is to think about, what does God do? What is God doing through these men? You see the power of God. And that is really helpful to think about as we go on and try to be servants of His. God proves in this story that He is the greatest God. Nebuchadnezzar believed he had all the power and everyone had to serve him. He believed there was not a God out there that could save these men from his hands. Well, Daniel was able to tell him his dream and give its interpretation in chapter 2. But what God is there is able to save from the fire? God was about to teach him and us a very valuable lesson. As he watched these three men enter the midst of the fire and walk around in there, notice what Nebuchadnezzar learned from this event. In verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar says, "Your God is the Most High God. Even though he had defeated Judah, and what he would claim in that is, my God is more powerful than their God. Nebuchadnezzar now knows that's just not good logic. These men's God, they worship the Most High God. And then notice verse 29. Not only does he recognize that, he also recognizes this God deserves to be worshipped. This God deserves to be worshipped. God proved to Nebuchadnezzar, to everyone around that situation, and to us, that he deserves our worship. Nebuchadnezzar made a law that no one was allowed to offend anyone who worshiped God. Think about all of the good that God brought out from this situation. This terrible situation where if you have to bow down to this God, which of course was one of the Ten Commandments, you shall not bow down to any image. He made that decree, and because of that, what God did to anyone who worships this Most High God is okay in my book. And anyone who mocks them, not okay. That can be really helpful as we go about our day. And sometimes I think we fear what people think of us, who we worship, what we do. If we remember, we serve the Most High God. It can change our attitude. It can change our mindset. And saying, I don't care what man thinks, or I don't care what this is, I get to serve the greatest God there ever is, or ever will be. Another thing that sticks out to me is the idea of obedience. Nebuchadnezzar demanded obedience in verses 6 and verse 15. Obey me or go into the furnace. How did that work for him? Not very well. God's way of obedience is he gives us free choice. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not afraid of death. I asked you to think about that one phrase. It says, God can deliver us from the fire. He will deliver us from your hand. But if he does not deliver us from the fire, it doesn't change what we're going to do. Let me ask this question. What if these three men went into the fire and were killed by the fire? Did God deliver them from Nebuchadnezzar's hand? He did. Either way, right? Whether God chooses to save them from the fire or not, either way, God delivers them from the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Either way, life or death, God does what they said he would do. He says, we're not going to bow down to your image and worship your gods or that golden image that you have set up. Our loyalty is to God, even in the face of immediate death. Unlike Nebuchadnezzar, God does not demand obedience. He gives us a choice. They obeyed God because they were convicted. They did not because of it's convenient for me to do so. They told Nebuchadnezzar, it doesn't matter to us. If we live or die, God is going to deliver us from your hand. When things get difficult and hard, that's the attitude we need to have. No matter what happens, the God we serve is able to deliver us. Are we willing to serve God when it is not convenient for us to do so? We learn that here in this story. Why should we serve God? Why did they make the great choice of serving Him? There are places where it is extremely difficult and challenging to worship God. Many, many years ago, I can't think how many, but my dad went to China, and he had a lot of Bibles in his suitcase. And at the top of the suitcase was all of his clothes. And he would go on their train or subway, and he knew of situations where the police would come and, "We want to check your baggage." And if they found any Bibles in there, then he would be taken to jail. And so Dad had all these Bibles, and he did not get stopped by the police or asked about his luggage. And they were in a hotel room worshiping God, where they had to be extremely quiet in fear of those who could persecute them. I learned in more current day, in Australia, you can only go outside for 1 hour, and you have to stay in your house. And so they are making sure that they stay put. What if that were to happen here? And I think for me, in my brain, it's like, I just don't think that'll ever happen here. I don't know. I don't know the future. But just pretend with me, what if it did? What if there was heavy persecution from the authorities if we worship God? What would we do? It's really helpful to be convicted now what you're going to do, instead of, "Well, I'll figure that out when it comes." These three men proved back in chapter 1, we're going to do what God wants us to do. And they proved it again here in chapter 3. We have a God who can deliver us from death. You remember when Paul was coming back from his third missionary journey, and he's coming back to Jerusalem, and the text says that in every city that he went to, there was a prophet who said, "Bonds and afflictions await you when you go to Jerusalem." And so when the prophet would say that, there would be the whole congregation, "Oh, Paul, please don't go, don't go." And then he gets closer to Jerusalem, and the prophet Agabus gets Paul's belt and starts tying himself, Agabus, up with Paul's ropes. And he says, "This is what's going to happen to the man who owns this belt." You remember Paul's attitude during all that, when all these people are saying, "Okay, that's it, Paul. You're staying here. We want you alive. Please don't go to Jerusalem." This is what he says: "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be bound, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord. Doesn't matter to me." In Philippians chapter 1, verse 21 through 24, he says, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." To die is gain. "But if I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me. And I do not know which to choose, but I'm hard-pressed in both directions, having the desire to depart and to be with Christ, for that is very much better." If you were to ask Paul, well, easy decision. Just go on, I get to be with the Lord, that's wonderful. But, he says, "I think to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. So it doesn't matter whether I die or to live, I live for Christ." I think that's the attitude we see in these three men. What is our attitude towards persecution? I think some is avoid it at all cost. And I think sometimes that's how we pray. If we know of someone that's going to be in a difficult situation, we pray for the kind of the best situation to occur. Let them have no difficulties. Heal them from their sickness. I'll just let you think about this. Maybe a better prayer: keep them safe during their struggle. And if they need to struggle, if this is good for them, let them lean on you. And I think sometimes we get it in our heads that we just want the best case scenario every time. Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego said, we don't care what the consequence is. We are going to stay faithful to God. Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. He says, rejoice, rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. From the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. I thought about going to Hebrews chapter 11 at the very end, where he's given all those details, by faith so-and-so did this. And then at the end, he just kind of gives a shotgun approach. You know, I can't have time to tell you about Gideon and David and all these men and the prophets of saving from lions and all these things. And then he gives another list right after that. All of those lists are really good and exciting. Look how God saves. There's another list that says, and there's some who died. Some were sawn in two because of me. Sometimes God chooses to let us suffer. James says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Peter, in the passage that was read for us tonight, says, when you are going through the fire, that is able to help you and purify you, and you come out better than you were before the trial. Remember, there was a fourth man in the fire. That was a perfect song, Philip. I don't know if you had this in mind or not, but it was very well done. Abide with me. That fourth man in the fire was with these three men in the fire. I think that's helpful to remember. It's helpful for me to remember. God is with us through the fire, through the trial. Our faith will be tested. I don't know how. I don't know when. But may we be like these three men and have the attitude that God is able to deliver us. Now, I don't know how he's going to do that, what that means, but he's able to do that. And because he is able to deliver, he is the God I'm going to serve. He is the Most High God. Jesus is with us and can help us just like these three men. Maybe some of you are going through a trial, are going through fire. I don't know. But I want us to all to remember, Jesus is with us, and it's our job to abide with him. He will help us. He loves us. And the wonderful thing about trials is they can make us better. You may think about Job and what God allowed to happen to Job. Job was even stronger for the Lord. At the end of the book, than in the beginning, where he said, "Have you considered my servant Job blameless?" Trials are able to help us if we let them, if we keep our eyes and our mindset right, remembering my God is able to save. If there's anyone here who needs to respond to the gospel in any way, needs the help, prayers, please come forward as we stand and as we sing.